Chapter 2. 3 days later. We are all about worn out. For 4 and 20 hours our bristling premises were the talk and wonder of the town. The theaters languished, for their happiest scenic inventions were tame and commonplace compared with my lightning rods. Our street was blocked night and day with spectators, and among them were many who came from the country to see. It was a blessed relief on the second day, when a thunderstorm came up and the lightning began to over my house, as the historian Josephus quaintly phrases it. It cleared the galleries, so to speak. In 5 minutes there was not a spectator within half a mile of my place, but all the high houses about that distance away were full, windows, roof, and all. And well they might be, for all the falling stars and 4th of July fireworks of a generation, put together and rained down simultaneously out of heaven in one brilliant shower upon one helpless roof, would not have any advantage of the pyrotechnic display that was making my house so magnificently conspicuous in the general gloom of the storm. By actual count, the lightning struck at my establishment 764 times in 40 minutes, but tripped on one of those faithful rods every time, and slid down the spiral twist, and shot into the earth before it probably had time to be surprised at the way the thing was done. And through all that bombardment only one patch of slates was ripped up, and that was because, for a single instant, the rods in the vicinity were transporting all the lightning they could possibly accommodate. Well, nothing was ever seen like it since the world began. For one whole day and night not a member of my family stuck his head out of the window, but he got the hair snatched off it as smooth as a billiard ball, and, if the reader will believe me, not one of us ever dreamt of stirring abroad. But at last the awful siege came to an end because there was absolutely no more electricity left in the clouds above us within grappling distance of my insatiable rods. Then I sallied forth, and gathered daring workmen together, and not a bite or a nap did we take till the premises were utterly stripped of all their terrific armament except just 3 rods on the house, 1 on the kitchen, and 1 on the barn, and, behold, these remain there even unto this day. And then, and not till then, the people ventured to use our street again. I will remark here, in passing, that during that fearful time I did not continue my essay upon political economy. I am not even yet settled enough in nerve and brain to resume it. To whom it may concern. Parties having need of 3,211 feet of best quality zinc-plated spiral twist lightning rod stuff, and 1,631 silver-tipped points, all in tolerable repair and, although much worn by use, still equal to any ordinary emergency, can hear of a bargain by addressing the publisher. The Jumping Frog, written about 1865, in English, then in French, then clawed back into a civilized language once more by patient, unremunerated toil. Even a criminal is entitled to fair play, and certainly when a man who has done no harm has been unjustly treated, he is privileged to do his best to right himself. My attention has just been called to an article some 3 years old in a French magazine entitled, Revue des Deux Mondes, Review of Some Two Worlds, wherein the writer treats of S. humorists Americans, these humorist Americans. I am one of these humorists American dissected by him, and hence the complaint I am making. This gentleman's article is an able one, as articles go, in the French, where they always tangle up everything to that degree, that when you start into a sentence you never know whether you are going to come out alive or not. It is a very good article, and the writer says all manner of kind and complimentary things about me for which I am sure thank him with all my heart. But then why should he go, and spoil all his praise by one unlucky experiment? What I refer to is this. He says my Jumping Frog is a funny story, but still he can't see why it should ever really convulse anyone with laughter and straightway proceeds to translate it into French in order to prove to his nation that there is nothing so very extravagantly funny about it. Just there is where my complaint originates. He has not translated it at all. He has simply mixed it all up. It is no more like the jumping frog. When he gets through with it, then I am like a meridian of longitude. But my mere assertion is not proof. Wherefore I print the French version, that all may see that I do not speak falsely. Furthermore, in order that even the unlettered may know my injury, and give me their compassion, I have been at infinite pains and trouble to retranslate this French version back into English. And to tell the truth, I have well nigh worn myself out at it, having scarcely rested from my work during 5 days and nights. I cannot speak the French language, but I can translate very well, though not fast, I being self-educated. I ask the reader to run his eye over the original English version of The Jumping Frog, and then read the French or my retranslation, and kindly take notice how the Frenchman has riddled the grammar. I think it is the worst I ever saw, and yet the French are called a polished nation. If I had a boy that put sentences together as they do, I would polish him to some purpose. Without further introduction, The Jumping Frog, as I originally wrote it, was as follows.
After it will be found the French version is deleted from this edition, and after the latter my retranslation from the French.
The notorious Jumping Frog of Calaveras County,
pronounced Calivaras,
in compliance with the request of a friend of mine, who wrote me from the East, I called on good-natured, garrulous old Simon Wheeler, and inquired after my friend's friend, Leonidas W. Smiley, as requested to do, and I hereunto append the result. I have a lurking suspicion that Leonidas W. Smiley is a myth, that my friend never knew such a personage, and that he conjectured that if I asked old Wheeler about him, it would remind him of his infamous Jim Smiley, and he would go to work and bore me to death with some exasperating reminiscence him as long and as tedious as it should be useless to me. If that was the design, it succeeded. I found Simon Wheeler dozing comfortably by the barroom stove of the dilapidated tavern in the decayed mining camp Angels, and I noticed that he was fat and bald-headed, and had an expression of winning gentleness and simplicity upon his tranquil countenance. He roused up and gave me good day. I told him that a friend of mine had commissioned me to make some inquiries about a cherished companion of his boyhood named Leonidas W. Smiley Rev. Leonidas W. Smiley, a young minister of the gospel, who he had heard was at one time resident of Angel's Camp. I added that, if Mr. Wheeler could tell me anything about this Rev. Leonidas W. Smiley, I would feel under many obligations to him. Simon Wheeler backed me into a corner, and blockaded me there with his chair, and then sat down and reeled off the monotonous narrative which follows this paragraph. He never smiled, he never frowned, he never changed his voice from the gentle flowing key to which he tuned his initial sentence, he never betrayed the slightest suspicion of enthusiasm. But all through the interminable narrative there ran a vein of impressive earnestness and sincerity, which showed me plainly that, so far from his imagining that there was anything ridiculous or funny about his story, he regarded it as a really important matter, and admired its two heroes as men of transcendent genius in finesse. I let him go on in his own way, and never interrupted him once. Rev. Leonidas W.H.M., Reverend Lowell, there was a feller here, once by the name of Jim Smiley, in the winter of 49, or maybe it was the spring of 50, I don't recollect exactly, somehow, though what makes me think it was one or the other is because I remember the big flume weren't finished when he first come to the camp. But anyway, he was the curiousest man about always betting on anything that turned up you ever see, if he could get anybody to bet on the other side. And if he couldn't, he'd change sides. Any way that suited the other man would suit him anyway, just so's he got a bet, he was satisfied. But still he was lucky, uncommon lucky, he most always come out winner. He was always ready and laying for a chance, there couldn't be no solitary thing mentioned, but that feller would offer to bet on it, and take any side you please, as I was just telling you.
If there was a horse race, you'd find him flush, or you'd find him busted at the end of it. If there was a dog fight, he'd bet on it. If there was a cat fight, he'd bet on it. If there was a chicken fight, he'd bet on it. Why, if there was two birds sitting on the fence, he would bet you which one would fly first. Or if there was a camp meeting, he would be very glad to bet on Parson Walker, which he judged to be the best exhorter about here, and so he was too, and a good man. If he even see a straddle bug start to go anywheres, he would bet you how long it would take him to get to wherever he was going to, and if you took him up, he would foller that straddle bug to Mexico, but what he would find out where he was bound for, and how long he was on the road. Lots of the boys here have seen that Smiley, and can tell you about him. Why, it never made no difference to him, he'd bet on anything, the dangdest feller. Parson Walker's wife laid very sick once, for a good while, and it seemed as if they weren't going to save her. But one morning he come in, and Smiley up, and asked him how she was, and he said she was considerable better, thank the Lord for his infinite mercy and coming on so smart, that with the blessing of Providence she'd get well yet. And Smiley, before he thought, says, well, I'll risk 2.5 she don't anyway. Fisher Smiley had a mare, the boys called her the 15-minute nag. But that was only in fun, you know, because of course she was faster than that and he used to win money on that horse, for all she was so slow, and always had the asthma, or the distemper, or the consumption, or something of that kind. They used to give her 200 or 300 yards start, and then pass her underway. But always at the fag end of the race she get excited and desperate-like, and come cavorting and straddling up, and scattering her legs around limber, sometimes in the air, and sometimes out to one side among the fences, and kicking up M.O.R.E. dust and raising M.O.R.E. racket with her coughing and sneezing and blowing her nose, and always fetch up at the stand just about a neck ahead, as near as you could siffer it down. And he had a little small bull pup, that to look at him, you'd think he weren't worth a cent, but to sit around and look ornery, and lay for a chance to steal something. But as soon as money was up on him, he was a different dog. His under jaw'd begin to stick out like the forecastle of a steamboat, and his teeth would uncover, and shine like the furnaces. And a dog might tackle him, and bully rag him, and bite him, and throw him over his shoulder 2 or 3 times, and Andrew Jackson, which was the name of the pup, Andrew Jackson would never let on, but what he was satisfied, and hadn't expected nothing else, and the bets being doubled and doubled on the other side all the time, till the money was all up. And then all of a sudden he would grab that other dog just by the jint of his hind leg and freeze to it, not chaw, you understand, but only just grip, and hang on till they throwed up the sponge, if it was a year. Smiley always come out winner on that pup, till he harnessed a dog once that didn't have no hind legs, because they'd been sawed off in a circular saw, and when the thing had gone along far enough, and the money was all up, and he come to make a snatch for his pet hold, he see in a minute how he'd been imposed on, and how the other dog had him in the door, so to speak, and he paired surprised, and then he looked sorter discouraged-like, and didn't try no more to win the fight, and so he got shucked out bad. He give Smiley a look, as much as to say his heart was broke, and it was his fault, for putting up a dog, that hadn't no hind legs for him to take hold of, which was his main dependence in a fight, and then he limped off a piece and laid down and died. It was a good pup, was that Andrew Jackson, and would have made a name for hisself if he'd lived. For the stuff was in him, and he had genius, I know it, because he hadn't no opportunities to speak of, and it don't stand to reason that a dog could make such a fight as he could under them circumstances, if he hadn't no talent. It always makes me feel sorry when I think of that last fight of his'n, and the way it turned out. Well, Fisher Smiley had rat terriers, and chicken cocks, and tomcats and all them kind of things, till you couldn't rest, and you couldn't fetch nothing for him to bet on, but he'd match you. He catched a frog one day, and took him home, and said he calculated to educate him. And so he never done nothing for 3 months, but sat in his backyard, and learned that frog to jump. And you bet you, he did learn him to. He'd give him a little punch behind, and the next minute you'd see that frog whirling in the air like a donut, see him turn one somerset, or maybe a couple, if he got a good start, and come down flat-footed and all right, like a cat. He got him up so in the matter of catching flies, and kept him in practice so constant, that he'd nail a fly every time as fur as he could see him. Smiley said all a frog wanted was education, and he could do most anything, and I believe him. Why, I've seen him set Dan Webster down here on this floor. Dan Webster was the name of the frog, and sing out, flies, Dan, flies. Apostrophe apostrophe and quick air new could wink he'd spring straight up, and snake a fly off the counter there, and flop down on the floor agin as solid as a gob of mud, and fall to scratching the side of his head with his hind foot as indifferent as if he hadn't no idea he'd been doing any more'n any frog might do. You never see a frog so modest and straightforward as he was, for all he was so gifted. And when it come to fair and square jumping on a dead level, he could get over more ground at one straddle than any animal of his breed you ever see. Jumping on a dead level was his strong suit, you understand. And when it come to that, Smiley would ante up money on him, as long as he had a red. Smiley was monstrous proud of his frog, and well he might be, for fellers that had traveled and been everywheres all said he laid over any frog that ever they see. Well, Smiley kept the beast in a little lattice box, and he used to fetch him downtown sometimes, and lay for a bet. One day a feller, a stranger in the camp, he was come across him with his box, and says, what might it be that you've got in the box? Apostrophe apostrophe, and Smiley says, sorter indifferent like, it might be a parrot, or it might be a canary, maybe, but it ain't, it's only just a frog. Apostrophe apostrophe, and the feller took it, and looked at it careful, and turned it round this way and that, and says, H apostrophe M, so 'tis. Well, what's he good for? Well, apostrophe Smiley says, easy and careless. He's good enough for one thing, I should judge he can outjump any frog in Calaveras County. The feller took the box again, and took another long, particular look, and give it back to Smiley, and says, very deliberate, well, apostrophe he says, I don't see no pints about that frog that's any better'n any other frog. Apostrophe apostrophe, maybe you don't, apostrophe Smiley says. Maybe you understand frogs and maybe you don't understand them. Maybe you've had experience, and maybe you ain't only a amateur, as it were. Anyways, I've got my opinion, and I'll risk $40 that he can outjump any frog in Calaveras County. Apostrophe apostrophe, and the feller studied a minute, and then says, kinder sad-like, well, I'm only a stranger here, and I ain't got no frog. But if I had a frog, I'd bet you. And then Smiley says, that's all right, that's all right. If you'll hold my box a minute, I'll go and get you a frog. Apostrophe apostrophe any. So the feller took the box, and put up his $40 along with Smiley's, and sat down to wait. So he sat there a good while thinking and thinking to himself, and then he got the frog out, and prized his mouth open, and took a teaspoon, and filled him full of quail shot, filled him pretty near up to his chin, and set him on the floor. Smiley he went to the swamp, and slopped around in the mud for a long time, and finally he catched a frog, and fetched him in, and give him to this feller and says, now, if you're ready, set him alongside of Dan, with his four paws just even with Dan's, and I'll give the word. Apostrophe apostrophe then he says, 1, 2, 3 get and him, and the feller touches up the frogs from behind, and the new frog hopped off lively, but Dan'll give a heave, and hissed it up his shoulders, so like a Frenchman, but it weren't no use, he couldn't budge. He was planted as solid as a church, and he couldn't no more stir than if he was anchored out. Smiley was a good deal surprised, and he was disgusted too, but he didn't have no idea what the matter was, of course. The teller took the money and started away, and when he was going out at the door, he sorta jerked his thumb over his shoulder so at Dan, and says again, very deliberate, "Well, apostrophe," he says, "I don't see no pints about that frog that's any better than any other frog." Apostrophe, apostrophe, Smiley, he stood scratching his head and looking down at Danley long time, and at last he says, "I do wonder what in the nation that frog throw it off for. I wonder if there ain't something the matter with him. He pears to look mighty baggy, somehow." Apostrophe, apostrophe, and he catched Dan by the nape of the neck and hefted him and says, "Why, blame my cats if he don't." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.